supermarket nowadays, when I grew up, they had food in them. And now they have all sorts of shit in them. Which tells me that shit is very cheap to produce and transport. And of course it is, because we got better at everything. So why aren't all prices going down forever? These devices in our pockets are James Bond's wet dream 20 years ago. I mean, everything is in this, right? But it's not only the digital realm, it's everything has become much cheaper to produce in terms of man hours. If we get better at doing stuff, then why aren't prices falling? Our money isn't reflecting that, and the only reason that it doesn't is because it's counterfeited. People can print it. The closer you are to the monetary spigot and the more assets you have, since they go up in value in comparison to the shitty fiat currency you're measuring from, then you win if you're already rich and you lose if it's very expensive to be poor in a fiat monetary system.
Yeah.
All tools and technologies that humanity ever invented had the same single purpose, and that was to save someone time somewhere. Because the only truly finite thing in our lives is our time. And since time is money, money ought to reflect time as directly as possible. Bitcoin, in being absolutely finite, is the best representation of human time we've ever had.
Down a rabbit hole. Down. Cypherpunk.
Welcome to Cypherpunk, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. I'm your host, Maddie, and joining me today is Knut Svanholm, Bitcoin author, philosopher, and the mastermind behind what might be the most viral five words in Bitcoin, everything divided by 21 million. Over the next 10 to 12 episodes, what you're about to experience is a complete philosophical demolition of everything you think you know about money, freedom, and human civilization itself. We're diving deep into Knut Svanholm's mind-bending book, Bitcoin, Everything Divided by 21 Million, a work that's been quietly circulating through Bitcoin circles like intellectual dynamite, waiting to explode into mainstream consciousness. Knut isn't your typical Bitcoin author. This is a guy who spent years sailing around the world, philosophizing under starlit skies, managing offshore wind farms, and then had his brain completely rewired by a simple mathematical equation, everything divided by 21 million. What started as a random tweet became a viral meme. What started as a meme became a philosophy. What started as a philosophy became a book that Michael Saylor retweeted and Jeff Booth called the most important idea competing for our attention. But here's what makes this series dangerous. Knut doesn't just argue that Bitcoin is better money. He argues that Bitcoin is humanity's evolutionary leap from cave dwelling to interstellar travel. It's literally a new element on the periodic table, which I thought was really cool. That it's the solution to 10,000 years of human violence. That it's going to make nation states obsolete and transform us into a completely different species. And the most terrifying part, the math checks out. Welcome to the show, Knut.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So as we dive into your book, this will be our very first episode on the very first chapter, which is time. What can you tell us about time?
That's a big question. What can I tell you about time? I can tell you a lot of things about time. The only thing we can experience is the present. But what is that? It's like the intersection between the past and the future, right? And the past is behind us. It doesn't exist. And the future is in front of us. It hasn't happened yet. And we're always living in the intersection between these two. And it's not even a point. It's literally where the two meet. And that's the only thing we can ever experience. That is not in the chapter of this particular book. And thanks for that introduction, by the way. It's an interesting way of introducing me. I'd say it's at 90% accurate, maybe.
What else can you give us?
I won't give you any more of that. But I won't bore you with that. The way I describe time in the book is how it relates to Bitcoin, because the only truly finite thing in our lives is our time. We know we're born, and we know we're gonna die, and we know we have to do whatever we choose to have to do in between those two points, right? Mm-hmm. So Bitcoin, in being absolutely finite, is the best representation of human time we've ever had. There's a great article by Gigi, called Bitcoin is Time. I can highly recommend that. That inspired this chapter a lot. So in the chapter, I think I argue for all tools and technologies that humanity ever invented had the same single purpose, and that was to save someone time somewhere. And this, it's all about delayed gratification. If in the praxeology book,
yeah, I was about to say that's a major part of praxeology.
Yeah, it's absolutely a major part of praxeology, and most Bitcoiners are familiar with the concept of time preference. And having a low time preference means that you have a large time horizon, so you plan for the far ahead into the future. And having a short time preference or a high time preference means that you are thinking of the immediate
instant gratification.
Yeah. So and those relate to those are two different modes of being in a way, and they relate to hope and fear in my mind. Because if you're stripped of all of your possessions, so you find yourself naked in a forest, you have to adopt a very high time preference because you need food and shelter to survive. So you need to find that as find ways of solving those two problems as quickly as possible. Otherwise, you die. And the opposite is when you have a lot of resources, a lot of money, a lot of assets. Like the more you have, the further into the future you can plan. And so I consider high time preference to be a state of fear. Because if you're naked in the, especially here in the Everglades, you would be shit scared because there are pythons and alligators and all sorts of other shit.
My girlfriend's dad coming after me.
Yeah, your girlfriend's
dad. The last time I was naked in the forest.
Yeah. yeah, so there are a plethora of things to be scared by. But anyway, that's why humans invent tools and technologies to save time. So the praxeological most basic example is Robinson Crusoe catching fish with his bare hands. So there's going to be a lot of Robinson Crusoe here. That's like Crusoe economics is a thing. Robinson Crusoe is a very good story for telling the basics of economics. Like you start with one person, one individual, and you study how different modes of action leads to different results for that one person. And then you introduce Friday, and then you introduce more people, and you can understand the boundaries of what economics can tell you and not. But anyway, Robinson Crusoe is fishing in his pond with his hands, and then he can catch X amount of fish per time unit. But if he, instead of doing this, chooses to save up a pile of fish for later use in order to be able to construct a fishing net, then after he's done with that, in doing that, he's delaying his gratification. He is adopting a lower time preference and thinking further ahead into the future. And once he has constructed the net, he can now catch Y amount of fish per time unit, and Y being larger than X, like he's increased his output per time unit by delaying his gratification. And this is the process of civilization. It's people doing things, creating tools and technologies to make life easier, to make stuff more efficient. And if you introduce other players into the market and you have a free market economy that functions well, then sooner or later, Robinson is going to have a fleet of robotic trawlers catching however many fish he wants.
Have you ever heard of the marshmallow test?
Oh, yeah. It's in one of the books. I think it's in the Sovereignty Through Mathematics. I go through that.
So haven't gotten there yet, but
Stanford marshmallow. That experiment is on kids. Like that, they put a piece of candy or a marshmallow right in front of the kid, and they tell the kid if you can stop yourself from eating this marshmallow for 10 minutes, then you can have two.
Yeah,
and the kids that pass the test usually score better on every metric.
They're more successful.
Yeah, every success metric that we have.
The ability to delay gratification is super important. It's something I try to teach my kids, but
But if you think about time more, if this concept of all tools and technologies being having the same purpose, and that is to save someone time somewhere, then you come to the realization like that money ought to reflect that. And money can only reflect that by being absolutely finite, because that means that... that's the gist of everything divided by 21 million. Mm-hmm. If we had this unit that we could fit everything into, then that would represent human time much better.
I think Parker Lewis was on a podcast at one point, and he said something like, "It what really made me understand this was, how can you measure something if the measuring stick keeps changing?
Yeah.
Like you can't actually get a real measure.
No.
You can't get any actual data, really.
No, you can't. And here is important to stress that money is not a measurement thing. Like it's a unit of account. It's still not. It's not a unit in the same way that a centimeter or over here an inch would be, or a kilogram or a pound mm-hmm. would be a measurement, because that measures something precise. But value cannot be measured. Value is always subjective and dynamic. Meaning that it's different for different people and in different times. So what you can do with money is signal value. So you, by putting a price tag on something, you signal how hard it is for you to give up that thing. If you're the seller of a thing, you say that I need this and that many units of this this type of money in order to give this up. And I like to explain stuff like this by asking people the simplest questions possible. So my question is usually, if a human being practices doing something, do they usually get better or worse at the thing they're practicing doing?
Better, obviously.
Yes. So why aren't all prices going down forever? Is the follow-up question.
Yeah.
And it's literally as simple as that. Yeah. If we get better at doing stuff, then why aren't prices falling? And you can see, like, supermarket nowadays, when I grew up, they had food in them. And mm-hmm. now they have all sorts of shit in them. Like you can buy... which tells me that shit is very cheap to produce and transport. And of course it is, because we got better yeah. at everything. We got better at production. We got better at transportation. Mm-hmm. It's not only in the digital realm that... these devices in our pockets are James Bond's wet dream 20 years ago. I mean, everything is in this, right? But it's not only the digital realm. It's everything has become insanely much cheaper to produce in terms of man hours. And our money isn't reflecting that. And the only reason that it doesn't is because it's counterfeited. And some people can print it, and we're working for a type of money that other people can print. And I urge everyone on earth to stop doing that and start working for a type of money that cannot be counterfeited.
Have you ever heard the expression, time is the currency of life?
Probably.
I always thought about that because, you know, people always say, oh, this is fair, that's not fair, this is fair. But if you break down time itself, you know, everybody has the same 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
So it's like the one thing that everybody has.
Yeah, and the same amount of it's very, yeah. Time yeah. is very socialistic like that.
Yeah.
there's a movie called In Time with starring Justin Timberlake.
I was about to ask you about that. Yeah. Time is the currency. Yeah. That was my next thread.
And that's very similar to Bitcoin, like even though... Yeah, the movie was a 7 out of 10 maximum, but anyway.
I love that movie. I thought it was great. I love when you get the part where he's like, he bets his whole life on the when he's gambling at the casino.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, if he loses, he'd lose everything.
Yeah.
He got it, he won it. It was like, that was pretty cool.
There's something to it, because money sort of ought to be that. Not saying that you should gamble your entire mm-hmm. life on a blackjack table, but still, there's a truth to that money should be rewarding responsible behavior and punishing mm-hmm. Reckless behavior.
I read a story yesterday too that speaking of this thread, the guy who started FedEx, I think it was FedEx, he was like, the company would have failed, but he went to the casino and he had like his last $10,000 from the company or something like that, and they couldn't pay their bills or something, and he put it all on like a hand of blackjack or something, and then he won and he was able to pay the bills for the next week or two. And then they were able
to save the company.
He saved the company. They were able to kind of like get out from the hole and rebuild and turn into the huge corporation they are today.
Not financial advice, I guess.
Definitely not financial advice, but it is a cool story.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So talk me through, people think they're free right now today and they think they've got, they don't feel like they're slaves. But when you really break down the math behind that, the amount of time they spend on things, can you create some, expound on that a little bit?
Sure.
In your book, you said 73%. You're 73% enslaved, I believe that was the name.
Yeah. So what is being a slave? That is when all your efforts, all the fruits of your labor go to someone else. So you give up, you don't get to keep anything, but you give everything away. Then you're 100% a slave, if that's the case. And if you're 100% free, you get to reap all the fruits of your labor. You get to keep everything, and you are free to do with it as you wish. And everyone on Earth is between these two points somewhere. And it depends on how much gets stolen from you over time. So through taxes and inflation, we are taxed way more than we think we are, mainly because of the money printing. So there's the tax that your normal tax rate, that's one thing. VAT is another thing that comes on top of that. But then you have all the other taxes, like property tax and capital gains tax and whatnot, all the other taxes.
Inheritance tax, debt tax.
Fucking tariffs.
Tariffs.
Yeah. All of that stuff. It's not only stealing. It's not linear, so that the more they steal, the less you lose, and it's a linear thing. Because the example I like to use is if the producer of a good is able to make 100% profit, the example I use in one of the books is an apple tree farmer. So he has one apple tree and he can feed X amount of people. And if he can keep all the profits and that can buy him a second tree, then he can feed the twice amount of people the next day or the next year. And year three, four, year four, eight, year five, 16 and 32 and 64, 256, 512, 1024, 2048, you know, 4096, 8192, 16,384. This is exponential growth.
Yeah.
And we don't see that because we're taxed and because we live with fiat money, which is the most devious tax that punishes the poor the most and the people who have assets the least. The closer you are to the monetary spigot and the more assets you have, since they go up in value in comparison to the shitty fiat currency you're measuring from, then you win if you're already rich, and you lose if it's very expensive to be poor in a fiat monetary system.
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can see it. I mean, what is it? WTF happened in 1971.com.
Yeah,
like it's pretty obvious if you look at the chart. I have to be retarded.
I would say it happened way earlier than that, though. Like back before World War One is when.
Oh, you're going all the way back. Yeah.
Yeah, before and I can go back even further. Like people compare Bitcoin to gold, but the reason that prices are relatively stable in gold and have been for the last 5,000 years is that our ability to find new gold
stock to flow
we've been better at finding gold at the same rate as we've been better at most other things.
Yeah.
So that's the only reason that prices are a cow priced in gold is about the same now as in the days of Mesopotamia. So that's very interesting, but Bitcoin is not gold 2.0. Gold is not very transportable, and it does have inflation. The stock-to-flow ratio is around 2% per year or something.
I think we just passed that with Bitcoin. Just has a lower stock-to-flow ratio.
Yeah, and you can say that Bitcoin never had any inflation because it was always predestined to have only 21 million coins. So if you take that into account when you do your accounting, then there is no inflation in Bitcoin. From one perspective, you can say that all the Bitcoin's already existed at the Big Bang. Like they are as old as time itself, because all the numbers already existed. Like, where are numbers? Like, what's a number? Where is it? It's in your head, right? And it's just that the hash rate was zero up until 2009, but they were always there. Yeah, we can go deeper into that too. But, let's get into that a little later, because I got a lot to say about that.
I've always been curious about why Satoshi chose 21 million. That's what has always been interesting to me.
Yeah, and is that the number he chose though? Because he chose 50 as the first, like the number per block, and then that was supposed to have every 210,000 blocks. So it's 50 and 210,000. And that leads to 21, almost 21 million, 140 years down the line.
Yeah.
So which number did he pick? And
I was just curious why he
like
chose
the,
that.
The way I see that is it doesn't matter that if any of the parameters had been different, then we don't know if Bitcoin would have worked. We know that it seems to be working now with these parameters. And it's sort of like if you tweak any of the constants of the universe, then the universe couldn't have existed. And it's sort of the same thing with Bitcoin. It exists now and the parameters are this. So you better study it and adapt to it rather than to try to change it. Or thinking about what any other number would have done is probably futile.
One of my favorite quotes from this chapter: inflation is mass time theft. Mm-hmm. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, if there's a $1 trillion in circulation and I print another trillion, then eventually each dollar will be worth a half of what it was. So I stole half of everyone's time. That's what I mean by that. Inflation is theft in terms of, and since time is money, like proper time, capital is another word for time, really. Mm-hmm. It's the delayed gratification. That is what it's all about. It's about the time preference. So therefore, money ought to reflect time as directly as possible. And Bitcoin is the best tool we have for that. Which is also, by the way, why capital gains taxes on Bitcoin are so stupid, because like you're getting punished for you gained nothing in terms of Bitcoin. If you use Bitcoin as the denominator, didn't gain anything.
Of course,
all you did was put on truth goggles to see the true prices of things, which are going down forever. So you just use the right way of looking at the world, and you're getting punished for it by the crooks in charge.
Any other rabbit holes of time you want to explore before we wrap this first episode?
I mean, Bitcoin is intersubjective time. And there's a lot of fun things to think about there. Because a new block is found on average every 10 minutes, at least in theory. In reality, it's more like 9.5 minutes, because hash rate has been going up and not down on average during Bitcoin's existence, which means that the process goes faster and faster.
Difficulty will just kind of keep rising.
Yeah, difficulty rises every 2 weeks on average. Mm-hmm. So it's 2016 blocks, and that's every 2 weeks.
Roughly every 2 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, it adjusts, but since it's been steadily going up, because more and more people get it, the time is not actually 10 minutes, but more like 9.5. And do you know how much time on average there is left till the next Bitcoin block is found? I mean, right now.
Aren't you always supposed to say 10 minutes on average?
Yeah.
Isn't that the correct answer?
It's always 10 minutes.
It's always roughly 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, 1048.
The funny thing about this is that what defines the 10 minutes is the 2 weeks, and what defines the 2 weeks is the 10 minutes. So it's like looping. It's the one is referring to the other, and the other is referring.
Yeah, it's this self-correcting kind of feedback loop.
And time, I mean, we experience time as a very specific thing here on Earth, but it's really a part of space-time. If you look out into the universe, gravity is just a curvature in space-time and all of this, and time goes in different speeds in different parts of the universe.
That blows my mind.
So there is no such thing as an objective time. Like this is the time now. It's always a specific point in space-time from a physics perspective. But from a human perspective, it could either be like what's closest to the approximate time in space-time point in physics, which is what clocks use, or we could just do intersubjective time, which is
that's what I'm curious about. Can you define intersubjective? What that means?
It's something that a lot of people believe in at the same time. So. An intersubjective idea can be very powerful, like the idea of nation state. At the end of the day, it's just an idea.
Just an idea. Yeah. Just a story.
And the same with money, the same with religions, the same with everything we do. Language is an intersubjective. Like, we both speak English here. I hope I do. But
you're doing great. But, keep it up. But
that's also an intersubjective idea. Like, any word we pick... if I say helicopter, you probably think of the same thing that I do, which is a party trick you can do. But no, it's not. I was about to say
we were thinking about the same thing. I was looking at Paul over there. Oh, that's funny.
But that's all it is. It's something. It's not something in objective reality, and it's not something personal to us, but it's something we can agree on. And so is Bitcoin. It's at the end of the day, it's just an agreement on a fixed set of rules. And the reason we agree on these rules and no other stupid rules, like shitcoin rules, is that these are the only rules that are actually more expensive to try to break than to follow, and that's what allows for the finite resource, the 21 million, the thing that cannot be copied, the holy Satoshi. That's what creates that.
I think that's a good ending point for our very first episode. We'll come back and we'll be talking about alchemy next.
All right.